Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you'd like to share it with your colleagues and classmates. We're delighted to have Adam Siegel with us today to talk about U.S.-China relations and cybersecurity. Dr. Siegel is CFR's Maurice R. Greenberg Senior Fellow for China Studies. He currently leads CFR's Cyber Conflict and Cybersecurity Initiative, writes for the CFR blog Asia Unbound, and tweets at ADS China, so I hope you all will follow him there. He was also the project director for a CFR-sponsored independent task force on Chinese military modernization, and prior to that, he was an arms control analyst for the China Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's been a visiting scholar at MIT Center for International Study, the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, and Tsinghua University in Beijing. And he is the author of the book, Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. Adam, thanks very much for being with us today. We've seen a lot in the news about cybersecurity risks that the United States faces from China and how this issue may be affecting U.S.-China relations. It would be great if you could walk us through this and give us your analysis of what we're facing.
Sure, and thanks very much for having me on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to put the U.S.-China relationship in cyberspace into a larger context and describe what I think how the two sides share very little interest. Talk a little bit about the logic of Chinese hacking and what the objectives are. Talk a little bit about the U.S. response, and then talk about why Chinese behavior might change over time, but you'll soon see that my heart really isn't in it. So when we think about Chinese interest in cyberspace, I think it's a good way to think about it is actually what the U.S. has stated its interest is. And the U.S. in the International Strategy on Cyberspace has said that it has an interest in cyberspace that is open, secure, and global and interoperable. If you take those three interests, the Chinese really share one of those, and that one is, in fact, two halves. So on open, that I think is fairly well known to everyone that the Chinese filter and censor content that comes into China and also filters and censors content that's produced within the Chinese web and internet primarily for domestic stability and regime legitimacy reasons. So that is always a constant irritant between the two sides. One of the halves is secure, and here the issue is partly one of semantics, because the United States refers to cybersecurity, which generally refers to the protection of networks and routers and computers, kind of the hardware side of things. And the Chinese, along with the Russians and others, will talk about information security. So they will be concerned both about the hardware and the routers and the content, but also about the threats of content. And what they call the information space or information warfare. So for the Chinese, the concern is not only a hacker who gets into the power grid, but also Twitter and Facebook. And you can see this in some of the comments that came out this week when General Dempsey met with Fang Fenghui of the PLA. And Fang's statement said, well, the internet is like a nuclear weapon, can have the effects of a nuclear weapon, which suggested that there was some kind of shared interest in the United States and China in addressing the concern, but also there was the language about managing the internet, which has usually to do about controlling content. So that's one of the halves. And the Chinese are becoming increasingly concerned about the threats of attacks on their industrial control systems and other types of networks. The other half is global and interoperable, which generally means technology standards that are used globally and that allow businesses to scale. When the Chinese hear that, they basically hear American standards, and they are afraid that they are too reliant on the West, particularly also in cybersecurity technologies and security technologies, where 90%, according to Chinese sources, of chips and other technologies are imported from the United States, and something around 65% of encryption technologies are imported from the West. So there's a real fear that the Chinese are going to be too dependent on the United States and the West in general, and that they want to develop their own technologies. So when we look at the two sides in cyberspace, we really only have this one shared interest, which is really the two halves. The logic of Chinese hacking, I think we can think about three types of hacks. And the first is kind of political or espionage, or sometimes political intimidation. And that is not only going after government agencies, and in some cases international agencies like the World Doping Institute and the IMF, trying to gather information that would be important for China to know, but also think tanks, media, and Tibetan activists, others who have a say in debates that affect China and China's view of the world. And part of this, I think, is just information gathering, and the other part of it is slightly, I think, intimidating. So in the case of the New York Times reports on the top leadership's wealth, reporters now have to worry about other sources going to be safe. What type of access are they going to get in the future? And with the Tibetan activists, it's clear that the point is to intimidate them and to silence their voices in these larger debates. And we've seen a whole wide range of targets, not just in the United States, but globally as well. The second, and this has been a major focus of the announcements from the NSA, Tom Donilon, and from the president himself, has been this focus on industrial cyber espionage, so the theft of U.S. trade secrets and other intellectual property. Here, the Chinese do not want to be the factory floor to the world forever. It's polluting, it's energy dependent, and they're afraid they're going to get caught in a technology trap. And so we have legitimate means of the Chinese trying to move up the value chain, increased focus on R&D and training of more science and engineering and math graduates. But we also have this other component, which is industrial espionage, which happens both in the real world. So we see lots of these cases now being brought to court in the States, but also in the cyber world. And the issue, I think, has been what is happening to all of this data. Where is it going? Since we haven't really seen Chinese companies moving up the value chain particularly quickly. The cases where we can spot to Chinese companies really benefiting from the stolen IP have been basically in the real world, people walking out of the door. On the military side, perhaps it's easier to see some benefits that the Chinese have made, that their stealth jet fighter, the fuselage looks specifically like the F-22. So that would be a more direct impact. And then finally, the Chinese in open source are very clear that they would use cyber attacks in a military conflict. There's a great deal of writing that in a conflict against a technologically superior adversary, the military, the PLA, would want to seize information control very early on. Cyber attacks against command and control nodes, transportation networks would all be very useful in slowing down this technologically advanced adversary. So they clearly are thinking about how they would blind the U.S. Navy or the U.S. Air Force in a conflict in across the Taiwan Straits, or perhaps in the South China Seas, or these are other places. And then there is also a deterrent effect, in the sense that to the extent that Chinese hackers are present in the U.S. power grid or other critical infrastructure networks, and they leave perhaps intentionally signs behind that they were in those networks, that sends a signal to U.S. policymakers that a regional conflict may in fact escalate, and the U.S. homeland is not going to be immune from attacks. The writings on these seizing of information dominance are particularly worrying from a stability point of view, since at least, again, in the public writings, the Chinese analysts don't seem to be particularly concerned about unintended outcomes and escalation. How do you control this series of attacks that would happen? And what happens if you take down a network and there's a cascading effect and you end up taking out electric power grids that support hospitals or things like that? And there is also a strong focus on offensive advantage, that you have to move quickly, the first mover advantage, which creates a high degree of instability for both the U.S. in China. Before I kind of end about what we've been doing and why the Chinese might change, it's probably important to point out that the Chinese see a high degree of hypocrisy in the U.S.'s position, in particular because they see us as saying we are interested in developing international norms for the use of cyberspace, but they point to the setting up of Cyber Command, the recent announcements about the increasing of the budget, the developing of offensive cyber capabilities as being signs that we are the ones that are weaponizing cyberspace. And then it's widely accepted that the United States was behind Stuxnet. Although there's no official kind of Chinese statements about it, the Chinese press reports it as it is a fact. What the U.S. has done in response so far has primarily been naming and shaming. So, you know, over the last 2 years, a steady escalation of calling out China as the adversary, and then all of this basically kind of cascading and reaching its high point in the last month with the speech from NSA Donilon at the Asia Society, and then President Obama mentioning it in an interview and raising it with Xi Jinping when he called to congratulate him for being president. We have not seen any reaction yet on the Chinese side, at least in reducing the numbers of attacks. In fact, the reports that came out this week suggest that they are continuing at the same pace, if not increasing. Although there was the positive sign that when Secretary Kerry was in China, the Chinese said, yes, we're interested in forming a working group on cybersecurity. Why Chinese behavior might change over the long term, I think we can point to three things. The first is increased vulnerability, and that as the Chinese economy and the Chinese military itself becomes more dependent on networks, they're going to become, if not as vulnerable, but more vulnerable, close to as vulnerable as the United States is. And so right now the Chinese think that the U.S. is more vulnerable, and so as that calculus changes, it maybe the Chinese are more willing to work on agreements. The second, and I have no evidence for this, but there must be factions within the Chinese leadership or policymakers who think that these attacks are not a good thing, both for innovation, right? If you want China to move up the value chain, copying and stealing from other countries is not the long-term way to do it, and also because it is risking important bilateral relations. It's not just the U.S. who is increasingly vocal about the cyber attacks, but also the EU, and this is another irritant in the China-Japan relationship. So there must be some who think that this is not good for long-term stability. And then third, traditionally China has not liked to be outside of international norms. In fact, it has moved over time closer to those agreements. And proliferation and counterproliferation is a good example here. The Chinese, of course, are not perfect, but they're certainly much better than they were in the 80s. And so you could imagine that if you did manage to define some type of norms about how these weapons could be used, that there would be pressure on China. But all of these are long-term policies that are not going to affect that have any impact on the short term, and so I suspect we'll continue to see much of the same behavior. And I'll stop there, Arena.
Thanks, Adam. That was terrific. Let's open it up to questions from the group.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, the floor is now open for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing star 1 on your touch-tone phones. We will take questions in the order they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star 1 now. Our first question comes from Fordham.
Thank you very much. The question I have here are there really two Chinas? For years, the military have been running their own profit-seeking enterprises, mostly in counterfeiting, maritime piracy, and now in cyber attacks and cyber crime, and then the government running their own industries as well. Can the government control the military, or should the United States be concerned about both China's military and the government in trying to deal with cyber security?
I think there is some concern about what the central leadership knows about what the military is doing, but I think part of that is not necessarily unique to China. I think cyber operations probably in any country are going to be fairly unknown in many cases to the top leadership unless they have the most kind of tight oversight in place. I think, you know, we see, for example, on the maritime side with the maritime conflict in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea that we have, you know, seven or eight different agencies that are involved over China's claims in those areas. There doesn't seem to be we don't know how much oversight there is. There is a small group, leadership group, that deals with maritime issues, but we don't know if that exists in the cyber side. I think also what happens on the cyber side is that there is competition, right? So there's a kind of competitive ecosystem where hackers from different agencies are just trying to gather as much information as possible. And you see from incident response companies in the United States that they, when they are called to a company, they may find six or seven different hacking groups in the networks. And so we don't really know if they are being coordinated or being deconflicted from the Chinese point of view. So I do think that is a concern, especially when I talked about those issues about stability, instability and kind of crisis escalation. If you have all of these different groups moving and acting, it becomes very hard to figure out what signals you're sending.
Well, do you think the military could take over the government?
No, I don't think actually the military is operating independently of the government right now. I think what we have seen almost consistently is that the central leadership and the military share the same strategic goals. It's been clear that the party leadership controls promotion and other personnel decisions. So I don't think of the military as being an independent actor in that way, no.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Norwich University.
How you doing, sir? I was just wondering what you thought of the recent defense white paper that they just put out. Do you think it's a bunch of fluff, or do you think we could actually trust in them wanting to open up their military a little bit more?
Well, with the white papers over time, we have seen greater transparency. So that has generally been a fairly a good sign of progress, but you know, nowhere near what the United States military has been asking in return. And this white paper changed a little bit. It was organized more thematically as opposed to the ones that the last 2 years ago, which was more had kind of the same sections over and over again, and each time with a little bit more detail. The Chinese have consistently said that, you know, they are the weaker power in this relationship, and to ask them to be more transparent is, you know, strategically it makes no sense for them, and in fact acts as a deterrent for us to just kind of show them how much more technologically sophisticated our military may seem. So I think there is some positive signs there, but it is still very hard to figure out how much more the Chinese are going to move forward on that front.
Thank
you. Next question.
Next question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
Hello, Mr. Siegel. I was actually curious about how deterrence is going to play out in this cyber world. I read your statements in the 2011 congressional hearing, and I was curious because you argued that American technology companies need to be more vocal about the theft of their IP, and because there's not direct admission by the part of the PLA that this is a military effort. I was wondering if communication and capability would interfere with how deterrence works out in a cyber world, as opposed to how it does in the real world, and how that applies to the regional conflict.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's very hard to apply deterrence in the cyber world, right? So mostly what we're talking about with the Chinese are these is espionage, and it's impossible, I think, to deter espionage through cyber when clearly it's not working. I think, you know, what you have to talk about there is deterrence through defense, right? Making it more difficult for the Chinese to get in. I do think some deterrence exists if you're talking about cyber attacks or, you know, cyber war. If you're talking about deterring the Chinese from turning off the power grid, I think in that context there is right now a kind of deterrence. The U.S. has clearly stated that we will respond to those types of attacks in any way we see fit. We've also kind of said, although it's a question about how credible that claim is that we're getting better at attribution, so we have a better sense of where the attacks come from. And so, especially if it happened during a political crisis or a military crisis, right? If we were already face to face with the Chinese over something that happened in the South China Sea, then I think deterrence would hold. The Chinese would have to think that we would think it was them in a cyber attack. So it depends on what type of hacking we're talking about and what type of conflict we're talking about.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Coastal Carolina University.
Do we know exactly what the Chinese have stolen from the U.S. companies?
We do not. So there are estimates about what the range may be, which is something from about 0.5 to 0.1% of GDP, which comes in the range of 25 to 50 billion. 25 to 125 billion. 25 to 125 billion. But there is no accepted numbers. General Alexander has talked about it, about the greatest transfer of wealth in history, but what that actually means is very unclear. And then part of the issue has been that companies are very reluctant to actually admit that they've been hacked or to discuss what's been stolen. So there was a story in Bloomberg several weeks ago that of the 27 companies that have actually publicly admitted that they were hacked, none of them filed an SEC report that said they were materially affected. So we really have no sense of how much has been stolen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. Does the threat of cyber conflict make it more difficult to deal with geopolitical issues in Asia?
Well, I think what we're going to have to think of is that cyber attacks and cyber is now going to be part of every conflict we have in Asia and, for that matter, the rest of the world. So, we can see with the standoff in the Korean Peninsula that cyber attacks were part of it, right? These attacks against Korean banks and the Korean broadcasters. We're not certain where those attacks came from. They appear to have come from North Korea, but they clearly heighten tensions and, I think, increase instability because we have no shared upon norms about what these attacks mean, right? So the U.S. has said clearly that an attack that causes death or widespread destruction would be considered an act of war. But beyond that, you can imagine that there are a range of attacks below that threshold that we might want to respond to. So just you take the Twitter hack that happened yesterday where the stock market dropped 138 points. If that had been a more concerted effort and the stock market had gone down for several days and caused real hundreds of billions of dollars over a long time, the U.S. would probably would want to respond. Would we decide that was an act of a use of force or an act of war? Those are all going to be political decisions. So it's clearly going to increase stability. And given that none of the parties agree and know what the other side thinks, I think it makes it much more dangerous.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Boston College.
Hi, thank you. My question just has to do with the fact that the DoD views cyber as a cyberspace as a fifth domain, but unlike the other four, air, space, land, and water, cyberspace relies a lot more on human capital and not so much military power. I guess my question is, what exactly does the U.S. or should the U.S. do, considering that we have a lot more students in China graduating with, I guess, more math and science degrees?
Yeah, so talent is a real issue. And as you said, there is a kind of widespread concern about the number of graduates in the STEM in the United States versus China. I guess one answer is that there is still a massive kind of quality gap, and so the training at most American universities is still much, much better than at most Chinese universities. So there is that, but it is a serious issue, and there's a large number of retirees that are actually in the system, or soon to retire people in information security. So people are trying to think of more creative ways. I think people might have seen the story on, you know, hacking competitions, trying to get young people involved. There's also people talking about Hack for America, kind of people that move in and out of the government short term, so you don't have to, you know, work at the NSA for the rest of your life, but you might do it for 6 months and then go start a company. There's also going to be real clearance issues, right? How do you get people in and out? But there has been several reports done on talent and human capital that are kind of looking at this problem.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Carnegie Mellon University.
The question is about the legal structure in China and how important that's going to be in the future in deterring some of these cyber espionage attacks.
I'm sorry, can you expand a little bit on that? What do you mean by the legal structure in China?
We should open his line if you've closed it.
His line is still open.
Okay. Can
you hear me?
You want to clarify?
Oh. Hang up. Okay, now.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry, we were on mute. the question is more about unless there's a more robust and serious legal and court structure in China that recognizes international IP and domestic IP, I feel like there's very little deterrent out there for basically just stealing IP. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on, is there any plan to reform the court structures and things like that in China?
So the issue isn't so much the court structure or the rules. Like, the Chinese actually have very, very good rules protecting IP, but the problem, of course, is enforcement, which is what they generally don't enforce it. There has been some, you know, progress over time. If you look, you know, the reports from, for example, the Business Software Alliance, you know, the percentage of pirated software in China has gone down from, I think, 90% to 78%, and Chinese government offices are now actually no longer using pirated software. That has been reduced. You know, the argument has always been once the Chinese have their own IP to protect, then they will start doing it. I don't know if I'm less convinced about that over the long term, but you could probably make a similar argument on the cyber side and protecting it. And there are reports in the Chinese press of Chinese companies hacking each other and stealing their IP. So, again, once it threatens their own companies or threatens their own critical infrastructure, then I can think you would be good just seeing the enforcement of the rules.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Colin Powell Center.
Hi. So in the U.S., we have rogue factions like Anonymous who are cyber criminals versus state-sanctioned cyber warfare. How do you differentiate between cyber warfare and cybercrime on an international level within the anonymity of the Internet?
It is not easy. And, you know, clearly, for example, in the... with the conflict between Israel and Hamas and the Gaza, second Gaza conflict, we saw kind of both state and non-state actors getting involved. I think that is going to be a kind of continuing characteristic of conflict from now on. You know, the Chinese in the standoff with the Philippines also had what they're called patriotic hackers operating. It seemed to be fairly independently of the government, although they did take some signals about when they should stop. So again, this is, I think, a real issue for if the two sides want to begin to control the conflict or send signals, that you could imagine that independent hackers or anonymous could then quickly make the situation grow more dangerous by doing a false flag operation or making it look like the state had done it. So I think, you know, there is an interest for the two sides to cooperate. There is an interest for nation-states to cooperate because these capabilities are diffusing to non-state actors. And so that, I think, is the positive side of the story. The question is, are we going to get to that point where we can cooperate before the capabilities of these non-state actors become more destructive?
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Georgetown University Law Center.
Hi there. In your December piece on China in 2013, you mentioned China's efforts to try to get technical control of the Internet moved over from ICANN in the U.S. to the U.N. and the fact that Russia supported that. I just wondered if that movement is picking up any steam, what other nations might be supporting it, how our allies feel, and what about the developing world?
So, yes, this is what kind of came to a head at the WICCID, at the World Conference World Communication in Dubai in 2012, where you saw the split between the U.S. and many other like-minded countries and China and Russia about extending the international telecommunication regulations to the Internet. This, you know, isn't over, right? So there's other meetings coming up this spring, both at the ITU and at WSIS, the World Society of Information Society. So those things are all moving forward. And I think the developing countries, actually, that's a big issue, because many of those developing countries are, if not sympathetic, to at least open to working with the ITU, less because they are sympathetic to the Chinese or Russian arguments about, you know, controlling information and censorship, but mainly because they lack technical expertise on cybersecurity, and they're used to dealing with the ITU, and it's a comfortable partner for them. So I think the issue for the United States and others is to how do you address these kind of legitimate cybersecurity concerns, but funnel those energies through the multi-stakeholder model that the U.S. has supported through ICANN and IGF, the Internet Governance Forum, and other places that we've done before, and how do you develop and build capabilities in the developing world so they're not turning to the Chinese and the Russians.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Syracuse University.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. You've touched a little bit on norms already, but in your opinion, would norm setting through the United Nations help deter cyber attacks and cyber espionage?
It's unlikely to have an impact on cyber espionage. Right, espionage, there is no norm against it. You know, the U.S. May try and develop a norm against cyber industrial espionage. But again, even that might be hard because, you know, there are friends of the U.S. that do this, that, you know, that spy on companies. But there is some discussion in the U.S. government about making this part of trade agreements or trying to bring to the WTO or TRIPS. The UN might be useful for cyber war or cyber conflict. There is a group that's part of the first committee that's called the GGE, the Government Group of Experts, that has been trying to identify some common norms and rules of the road. It issued a kind of an agreement or report the last meeting, which didn't seem like a lot of progress, but in the context it was, which basically said we agree we should talk about these norms and confidence building measures and other types of ways to dampen conflict. And they're going to come up with another report either this year or next, I can't remember. So I think there is a role for the UN to play there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Adelphi University.
Hi. My name is Naresh Singh, and I had a question pertaining to the hacking community. I was wondering, have we considered employing the use of the hacking community to strengthen the cybersecurity of the United States or other nations, for that matter?
We have. So, for example, there was a rather famous hacker called Mudge, who was working at DARPA until very recently and just left DARPA, the Defense Agency's research program entity, to go work at Google. But he was working on kind of cybersecurity, fast-tracking cybersecurity programs. Jeff Moss, who was another hacker, is now a consultant to the Department of Homeland Security. General Alexander went to either DEF CON or Black Hat, I can't remember which one, last year. And it's widely known that the NSA goes to these conferences to hack, to recruit other hackers. Other countries are also thinking about it, so there's been lots of discussions in India that I've seen about how do you get hackers to be, you know, patriotic hackers and work for the government, and the Japanese have also started having hackathons to try to attract these people.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from San Diego State University.
Good morning or afternoon, wherever you are, Mr. Stegall. My question is, I know you think about these issues a lot, and I was wondering what you could give us a worst-case scenario of what could happen in, the worst case of a hacking catastrophe.
Yeah, I tend not to be from the live free or die, the whole world is going to be turned off kind of scenario. It does seem that nation-state hackers, so primarily kind of China, Russia, the U.S., Germany, Israel, the U.K., maybe France and some others, could do serious damage. They could perhaps turn off the power grid and do physical damage, like we saw with Stuxnet. But, to cause widespread cascading outages in the United States is not all that easy because, many of the systems are actually not connected. They are many different types of software. You'd have to be kind of have a sophisticated knowledge both of hacking and the control systems that are being used. But those capabilities are going to develop. So, I think right now it would be a kind of a destruction of some type of pipeline, causing a spill or an explosion or something like that. That would be the kind of most dramatic impact. But that's going to change over time.
Thank you. Our next question.
Our next question comes from the Texas Women's University.
Hi, just a thought on the neo-mercantilist policies of China and how that relates to the cyber warfare. Because as it moves away from its communist regime and embraces the neo-mercantilist policies, what are your thoughts on the likelihood of these cyber attacks escalating?
Well, I think they're already are a part of that policies, right? They're already part of the Chinese efforts to force technology transfer from developed countries to China. It is already part of this effort to develop indigenous innovation, and so I think it's hard for me to imagine how much more escalation we can have, given how widespread it seems to be. And so I would suspect that it'll continue, and the question will be, if the Chinese decide that this model doesn't fit their needs, right, isn't helping them move up the value chain, in fact, doesn't create competitive Chinese companies, and they would adopt more open approaches, would we then expect to see the cyber espionage go down? Perhaps it would, given the tight links between there. Although for the political and military reasons, I think they would still have interest and objectives to follow through on that front.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1. Our next question comes from Coastal Carolina University.
This is a two-part question, Dr. Stegall. First of all, I've heard from talking heads in Washington that if we kept Chinese students from coming to our universities and learning our hardware and programs and then sending them back to China with that information, it might stop some of this from going on. And the second part is there anything that individuals, just people in America, can do to their computers to watch for hacking? Is there something that sends up a red flag, or is there anywhere we can go to report that sort of thing?
So I think on the issue with Chinese students, right, and Chinese visitors, there is a clear espionage threat, although I think we want to be careful of not shooting ourselves in the foot, in the sense that I think one of our greatest strengths has been, especially the American university system, is so open to students from around the world. Chinese, Indians, and everyone else, and they contribute and have continued to contribute so much to both our academic and economic life that we want to be very careful about how we think about how we're going to try to stop the flow out. I think, one of the issues would be with if a Chinese graduate student in computer science wants to stay in the United States and set a company, then we should make sure that they can pursue that through legitimate immigration means and not have them go back, right? We've spent all that money to educate them. That should be, one of our goals is to have them stay here. and set up the companies. There are lots of things you can do. The DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, has a cybersecurity website that can list a lot of the things that you can do to make sure that you are not hacked, and take some kind of, you know, individual cyber hygiene measures.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
Hi. I had a question about the normative legal structure. You advocated trying to get China to adopt some of these IP norms, and that will help them to stop hacking. But the way I see it, China isn't really fond of the status quo and fear encirclement, both geopolitically and in terms of you know, IP through the UN and the WTO. And I was curious, are there any dangers of bringing that normative structure into the cyber area that fuel aggression in any way?
I mean, the Chinese have not been very good at protecting IP, but they have embraced all of the agreements. They've signed the WTO, and they, you know, the Chinese are very proud that they are now the world's number one filer of IP patents. So I think the issue is, you know, are they undermining those regimes? I think, quite honestly, basically, yes, the Chinese are concerned from a military point of view about being containment or being contained or encircled. But for the most part, the last 30 years, the Chinese have really been a status quo power. They have really kind of embraced most of the international regimes. And I don't see them working to undermine them. It may be that eventually they will start promoting different ideas about how these things should be organized. But, you know, I think the issue has been, how do we get the Chinese to agree to do the things that they signed up to do? And that has been a problem because we don't have very many levers any longer, right? In particular, because U.S. companies have seemed to have adopted the idea that they know they're going to lose their technology if they go to China, but the benefits of being in the Chinese market are just too big, and so they're willing to make that trade-off. I think it's incredibly important for the companies to start realizing or to start questioning that willingness to lose the IP. Once the companies make a greater stink about it, then it's, I think, easier to get the Chinese to start living up to their commitments.
Well, if I could ask a follow-up question, what are the norms that should be instituted in terms of cyber warfare?
Well, in cyber warfare, I think it's still harder to say, right? I'm trying to make a distinction between espionage and warfare. But I think easy but probably more immediate things we want to do are kind of agree on legitimate targets and thresholds for armed conflict, right? Do we agree that if you cause death through an attack, that could be treated as an armed attack or use of force? Do we think that there should be some sort of proportionality and discrimination, meaning that certain types of targets should be off limits? Those are things that I think we should be having discussions on and that the two sides could begin making some progress on.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Carnegie Mellon University.
Good afternoon. You mentioned that so far the U.S. has pretty much been conducting a shame campaign, and that hasn't been very successful in reducing Chinese cyber exploitation efforts. What can we do? What aren't we doing to be more effective? And given the incentives on the Chinese side, you know, using sort of positioning as a deterrent, preparedness for military conflict, and of course, money in terms of IP, can the proposed U.S. Cyber-China Working Group hope to accomplish anything?
I think the Obama administration had a kind of short-term plan, which is the naming and shaming, and they basically wanted then to go to the Chinese leadership and say, look, the American public is aware of this problem. They're growing increasingly angry about it, and look what the Congress is considering doing. And so we need some sign from you that you're willing to reduce this so we can go to Congress and tell them to you know, rein in the legislative responses that they're considering. So that's what I think the Obama administration is happy to do. The legislative responses that are being considered are a range of things right now. So people are talking about trade sanctions, either identifying companies, Chinese companies that have benefited from IP theft, cyber theft, and then punishing them. People are talking about visa restrictions, so if you could actually identify individual hackers, although that's going to be very difficult to do, putting them on travel lists and saying that they can't travel to the United States or they can't travel to the EU or other places, and some other kind of more sanctions with more of a bite. But those are all at the legislative level. Although the Obama administration's anti-trade theft strategy says they will consider them, but none of those have been seriously broached yet. As I said in my talk, I am fairly pessimistic right now that there's a lot of incentive for the Chinese to change. Right, the benefits are too high and the costs are way too low. I really think it depends on what the working group decides to attack. If it attacks some of these issues that I was discussing earlier about some kind of shared agreement about what a armed attack looks like or what the targets, legitimate targets, will be, then that will be a useful a process. But if the working group thinks, I seriously suspect that the working group will not have any effect on cyber espionage, because if we do, we're just going to have a kind of back and forth where we, tell the Chinese to stop it, and the Chinese say we're not doing it, and criticizing us is unprofessional and unwarranted. So, if they focus on these other norms, there may be some progress.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one now. Our next question comes from the Colin Powell Center.
Hi, I had a question. Is it feasible to establish another branch of the military to specifically deal with cyber warfare in a formal manner?
So there is. What's happened is that for a long time, each of the services was developing its own cyber capabilities, and then the NSA, of course, had its own fairly extensive cyber capabilities. The military, of course, set up the Cyber Command. And now General Alexander is dual-hatted. He's the head of both NSA and Cyber Command. There is a debate going on about right now Cyber Command reports to Strategic Command. There is a debate about should it be its own separate command, separate from that, and have its own operating independently. I think what's going to happen is that they're going to, I don't think it's going to operate separately, as you said, that it's going to have to rely on expertise in the different services. But what's going to happen is that it seems to be is that they're going to be the capabilities are going to be available to the regional combatant commanders. So the Pacific Command, the Central Command, all those others are going to be able to draw on cyber capabilities, and then the services will decide. Which ones are the best fit for those operations.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from UC San Diego.
Good afternoon. In response to a lot of these naming and shaming tactics, the Chinese officials have repeatedly said that they're the largest victims in cyberspace, both from domestic hackers and from hackers abroad. Is cybersecurity or information security an area that the U.S. and China can increase cooperation, or at the very least get rid of this excuse from China that, that they're just the largest victim in this?
I think it's a good point. I think, that is an impetus for the U.S. to clean up its own act. And there have been cases where the Chinese have complained about command and control nodes for botnets and phishing being in the United States, and they didn't get the response as quick or as at any response that they hoped from the U.S. side. So I do think there is something to be said for the U.S. Addressing those concerns so we can kind of put the onus back on the Chinese, although we're still talking about two different hacking. We're still, in the U.S. it's criminals, and in the Chinese side it seems to be, state-directed cyber espionage. Some have suggested, can we work on crime together? So that's a shared interest. So there was a working group on spam and some cooperation on child porn. But again, sometimes those things become more difficult because they start spilling over into political issues. So spam, the line between spam and free speech is not always that clear. And then in the case of the child porn, the U.S. became worried that one of the alleged suspects on the Chinese side was actually a dissident. So there is room for that, but it's never easy.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. My question is, do you think the cyber attacks will affect the Chinese and U.S. trade relations?
So if the they continue and there is, I think, either congressional or administration action to move this into trade agreements, then definitely yes. It seems to be slowly eating at U.S. business confidence in China. If you look at the survey that came out last month from the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, that something like a quarter of the respondents said they'd already had IP stolen and 40% expected it to get worse. So that could have a long-term effect. And you could argue that it's already had an effect in the sense that the constant oversight and questioning of Huawei, the Chinese telecom company, and its efforts to expand in the United States have been seriously shaped by cybersecurity concerns.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, to ask a question, star one now. Our next question comes from Carnegie Mellon University.
One moment.
Hi. I just want to ask, what's the U.S. position in these negotiations about cybersecurity when the U.S. is the one actually, as you already said, leading this kind of confrontation in cyberspace, like the U.S. with Stuxnet? I mean, the U.S. is using the cybersecurity for almost war. So what's their position in telling other people don't use it for what you want to?
Well, I think, one, the U.S. hasn't officially taken any credit or claim for Stuxnet, so that, you know, and it has continued to argue that we need to have a discussion about these norms. The U.S. has officially stated that it believes that the international law of armed conflict already applies to cyber, right? So the humanitarian law already applies. But I think, you know, you point to an important point that the U.S.'s ability, not necessarily to convince Russia and China, because I think the differences there were already fairly widespread, but perhaps more importantly, to affect developing countries or, you know, large important cyber powers like Brazil and India and South Africa and Kenya and Turkey, those countries, to agree to kind of these discussions on norms when they are also going to be incredibly suspicious and skeptical of U.S. behavior, given all of the effort that we've been spending to build up U.S. capabilities.
Thank you. Our next question?
At this time, we have no other questioners. I'll turn it back to Ms. Vasconos for follow-up.
Adam, just as a final, your final thoughts on where you see U.S.-China relations heading and any other closing remarks you'd like to make since we're near the end of our hour.
I guess I would just end that I don't really think that I think cyber is going to continue to be a major irritant, but is very unlikely to cause a major rupture in the relationship unless there is an attack that causes real destruction in the real world. I think given that the two sides have so many other issues to work on, North Korea and Iran and the global economy, that the both sides are going to work very hard to make sure that cyber doesn't cause a rupture. And so it'll continue to be there, but it's not going to go away, and it's not going to force the two sides to make any dramatic changes.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. Just to flag for everybody on the call, Adam is the project director for CFR-sponsored independent task force on this topic. On U.S. policy in the digital age, chaired by John Negroponte and Sam Palmisano, and that will be forthcoming, the report, in June. So we hope you will look at that. As a reminder, you can follow Adam on Twitter at ADSChina and find more of his commentary and analysis on our website, CFR.org, as well as on the CFR blog, Asia Unbound. We will have a special edition of this conference call series with Richard Haas
in May. We're working to schedule that date now. Richard is the president of CFR and is coming out with a book in May on foreign policy begins at home. So we hope that you'll be able to break away from your finals and graduations to join us for that call. In the meantime, good luck with all of that. Please follow CFR's academic initiative on Twitter at CFR_academic for new resources and upcoming events. And we also urge you to, if you want to ask a CFR expert a question, you heard from one of our best today, Adam Siegel, but we are collecting those questions. You can submit them on our homepage, and a fellow will respond to selected questions. So we hope that you will take advantage of that new feature. So thank you again, and thank you, Adam Siegel.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.